Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to Jack Abramoff, once the most influential lobbyist in Washington, D.C. He talks about lobbying industry and power with Aliza Newland Carney. Jack Abramoff was convicted in 2008 of mail fraud and conspiracy. He was at the heart of an extensive corruption investigation that led to the conviction of White House officials J. Stephen Brills and David Sabanin, U.S. Representative Bob Ney, and nine other lobbyists and congressional aides. He served 3 years, 6 months, of a 6-year sentence in a federal prison before being released early to a Baltimore halfway house in June 8, 2010. And now on to Jack Abramoff.
Looking back, was there a turning point where you went from thinking that everything was okay to realizing that it was very much not okay?
Yes. The turning point was when my firm fired me. Up until that point, I thought, we'll just fight through this and everything will be okay. And I described the meeting in the book when they came in to see me, and I thought they were coming to tell me how we're going to turn this around. And instead they fired me, and that was devastating, and that made me realize that I wasn't probably coming back from this. I tried still to position myself to get through it, but at that point I probably realized that this was not going to end well.
If there's one thing you could do differently, what would it be?
Well, there's not one thing I would do differently. There are many things, but again, I'd be careful to follow every rule. I'd be careful to make sure that I didn't think that information that I had that my clients, for example, deserved to have to make decisions was not necessary for them to have. There are a lot of things that I would do differently. I'd probably try to, if I could, squelch this hyper-competitive attitude I have that I got to win, win, win no matter what. All those are destructive, and they're challenges, and I'm hoping that I've overcome a lot of them through the pain I've been through, but one never really knows, I guess, until you're put back into a situation.
You predicted in your book that the reforms that you proposed would not be well received by Washington lobbyists, and you're correct. Some of them have told me they take umbrage that you, and they consider you responsible for helping give lobbyists a bad name, would now come up with recommendations for how to change the system.
Right.
Does that surprise you?
No, of course not. I have a number of lobbyist friends. They're quietly my friends. I told them to be quiet about being my friends, or you're not going to have any other lobbyists as your friends. The lobbying world, I think, very conveniently wanted to make it that I was the one who besmirched the name lobbyist. I don't know where they've been for the last 150 years. I don't remember a minute when I was a lobbyist the lobbyists had a good reputation. I certainly didn't help, but I wasn't the only one. And I understand that they now feel that I have no right to come back and, frankly, go after the system. I'm not doing this to please them or not please them. I'm doing this because I feel that I have information that I can, in some way of making some recompense to the country, who I feel, frankly, a much greater fealty to than to the lobbying world. If I can do something that can help clean up the system and aid people in analyzing their government, then I'm going to do it. I understood, by the way, and I thought about this, that it could be very much easier for me to just be quiet and go away and not subject myself again to the media scrutiny and not subject myself certainly to the Hill and to the lobbying world and their scrutiny, which is intense. But I decided that that wouldn't be right. I went through this. I need to do something to make recompense. I am paying restitution. I'll probably be paying restitution for the rest of my life. That's one thing. I went to prison. My family has, you know, basically lost everything. My kids suffered. My wife suffered. My father suffered. My mother passed away. Certainly, I paid a big price, probably rightfully so, for what I did. But there's something positive I can do, and I'm going to do it. And if a bunch of lobbyists don't like it to me, they don't intimidate me. I've been in prison for 43 months. I don't think they should think that some lobbyists on K Street are going to intimidate me.
And you've been barred by the federal government from being a lobbyist, from doing any business.
Not from being a lobbyist. What I was barred was the Interior Department barred me from being a vendor. Not that I had any plans to be a vendor, but when I got out, they put through a debarment of me from the Interior Department. I had no intention of doing it. By the way, I don't intend to be a lobbyist either. If they had barred me from being a lobbyist, that would be just fine, but they didn't, and I don't think they can bar you from being a lobbyist. Yeah.
I see. But you would not want to be a lobbyist.
No, I don't want to return to a world where I rose to its top and then had my head cut off. There are plenty of other things to do in life. Frankly, I'd rather dedicate myself to doing something good and helping people in general.
So talk about what steps you're taking to promote changes in the system.
Well, I, A, wrote the book, and B, I'm speaking about it, and I'm trying to answer questions that people have, because even people who read the book have a lot of questions still, and obviously I couldn't put everything in the book. I'm trying to work with some of the reform groups, who, by the way, were my biggest adversaries and enemies when I was going through this. They were the people who went after me the most, and okay, that was their business and their job. But I reached my hand out and said, I was that guy who used to be me. Now I would go after him too. So let me try to be helpful if I can. Most of them are delighted and want to have me help if they can. Some are not. Some feel that I should name more names and put more people in jeopardy, and I don't want to do that, even people I don't like. It's not to me about individuals or people and destroying lives. And people don't think, I think, when they want to destroy somebody's life, that they have children, a family, and people who love them, and they suffer more than they do. But it's more than that. The fact is, every time we focus on a Jack Abramoff and all pat ourselves on the back that we threw him in prison and he's dead and he's the one who destroyed lobbying and destroyed Washington, we don't fix the system. We fix him. And I got fixed, there's no question about it, but the system didn't get fixed. And so what I'd prefer to do is, instead of focusing like that, I'd rather focus people on the system. Here are specific things that if we change them and we get people to change them, life will be a lot better for all of us.
One of the things that you recommend, which is that lobbyists be barred from making campaign contributions, mm-hmm. is very controversial. There are many lobbyists who say that's unconstitutional. Where do you think are the areas where there's common ground?
With the lobbyists?
Within the reform community and even the lobbying community.
I don't know that there's common ground with the lobbying community. I think what the lobbying community generally wants to do, now I'm not talking about the lobbyist who's out there just honestly plying their trade. I'm talking about the powerful lobbyists who care about these things. They don't want to be barred from giving contributions. They don't want to be barred from taking people to get dinners and things like that. I don't know that there is common ground, because ultimately those people, and I was one of them, use those tools to their advantage to get a leg up on not only the general American populace but other lobbyists. So they don't want those things barred. And so real reform isn't going to happen. What will happen are faux reforms, things like you have to sit down when you can't sit down when you're eating your meal, you have to stand up, if you use your fingers, it's okay, a congressman, stupid stuff. What I'm talking about is a root and branch barring of these things. Now, in terms of the constitutionality of it, North Carolina barred their lobbyists, the state, from giving any political contributions, and it was just upheld in the Fourth Circuit that what they did is constitutional. And I think people have to remember, it's one thing to bar people from giving money. It's another thing to tell somebody, if you want to be, nobody's forcing anybody to be a lobbyist, by the way, or take things from the federal government. But if you want to do that, then you need to give up certain things too. And I think those choices have been held up previously as constitutional. And that's the basis on which I hope that changes like this would be constitutional.
A number of people were caught up in this series of scandals that sent you to prison, and only one of them, a member of Congress, Bob Ney, mm-hmm. was a lawmaker, was an elected
right.
official. Do you feel that there's a sense in which when Congress goes to fix the problem, the focus goes to the lobbyists but not to themselves and to their own behavior?
Well, I think, I can just tell you what I was like when I saw a reform bill coming. We laughed. We knew that we'd get around it. We knew there would be loopholes, and so it doesn't really go after the lobbyists or the congressmen. Part of the problem, and one of the reasons Bob was the only one who went to prison, Bob apparently had a different issue that wasn't related to mine. He took $50,000 in casino chips from an Iranian businessman, apparently, who wanted the government to give permission to sell planes to Iran. Now, that act, in doing it in a casino in London, is what I think unhinged Bob. And Bob pled, by the way. If Bob had fought, I'm not sure where it would have wound up. Probably he would have been convicted. But in terms of the stuff with me, nobody else was indicted because a lot of the congressional action is protected under the speech and debate clause. In fact, William Jefferson, who famously went to prison because of $90,000 in his freezer at home in money that was marked bills from the FBI from a bribery operation that he was running, or extortion operation, if that freezer was in his office, he would be enjoying that money today. So there's a lot of protections that they have in Congress that prevent people, the Justice Department, from really investigating them.
You have been a filmmaker, you've invested in a casino cruise company, you've launched a restaurant, there's talk now of a reality TV show, I don't know if that's still live. What is next for you and what are you working on now?
Well, I am working on the reality show, I'm working on some other television, I'm working on things that are related to this space. I've got a social game app that we're developing that brings people into this world in a way that's fun, challenging, and frightening. I'm trying to do everything I can to confront the way the media are today in terms of the opportunities for young people and others to get educated. It's not just give a speech, write a book, go on television. There are other things that have to be done now. And so I'm trying to accommodate this message and this approach to that, and hoping that in doing so, we'll be able to widen the audience of people who care about it and people who are going to do something about it. So I'm still ADD and still out there doing 100 things, but a lot of them are sort of sitting in this space and trying to promote this.
And where do you think our campaign finance system is going next, especially in the wake of this Citizens United ruling, which has freed up corporate money and which seems to have angered so many people on both sides of the aisle?
Well, I don't know where it's going to go next. I hope it goes to where I hope it will go, and others who want to get the tainted money out of the system. That will just remain to be seen. It depends on the American people pushing these members to do the right thing. Again, campaign finance is a hot button. What I think we need to do is, like, I'm a conservative, and I've always been a conservative, but I'm working with liberals also and progressives who have the same view on the corruption side. We need to find those things where conservatives and liberals can agree. We're not going to agree on campaign finance, public financing campaigns. We could agree on barring special interests from giving money. We need to find those areas. We need to push those areas and hopefully solve the problems together, because in this atmosphere in Washington, if something's just from the right or just from the left, it's not going to go through.
Well, on that note, I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, Scott Horton interviews Chris Woods. Chris Woods is a documentary producer and freelancer for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and he discusses his article, Obama Terror Drones. CIA tactics in Pakistan include targeting rescuers and funerals. He also calls for a formal investigation of the secret war in Pakistan.
Out by our tears. war-torn countries, they are all of our children.
They can't remember a nighttime of peace with no shooting or crying.
We all live on the same earth. We fish and swim in the same oceans. We breathe the same air and gaze at the very
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm Scott Horton, and we're going to start off the show today with Chris Woods from the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. The BureauInvestigates.com is the website. We spoke to him last summer about drone strikes, CIA drone strikes in Pakistan. You might remember, and now he's got a new one done in cooperation with the Sunday Times of London, I believe it is, and with co-author Christina Lamb. It's called Obama Terror Drones, CIA Tactics in Pakistan Include Targeting Rescuers and Funerals. And it has quite a few sidebar articles as well. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you?
Thanks for having me on, Scott. Good, actually. Yeah, it's cold in London, but otherwise very nice today, yeah.
All right, well, I appreciate you joining us on the show. It's a very important story that you have here, an outrageous story. Is this really true? Can you prove it? What are your sources? How can you assert in writing here that the American Central Intelligence Agency would target rescuers and funerals?
It is a genuinely shocking story, I agree. We first came across this last summer when we were putting together a massive database on CIA drone strikes in Pakistan. And as part of that process, in fact, as you and I discussed last year, we went through literally thousands of press reports from the time from credible news agencies. And back then, we noticed there were multiple references to these attacks on rescuers. We didn't take that at face value. We thought that it was an important possible story. This was from news agencies like Reuters, from CNN, from New York Times. These were big media players who were reporting this individually. But we didn't just run that story as it was. We decided to look at this in depth and worked with field researchers out in Waziristan, working in conjunction with the London Sunday Times, to really get to the bottom of what were, on paper, 18 reports of attacks on rescuers and on funeral goers. And indeed, our researchers have stood up 12 of those strikes. 10 of them are attacks on rescuers. These are people, a mix of Taliban and civilians, who've come forward after an initial drone strike to help the dead and injured, who've been almost immediately attacked again by CIA drones. And on two occasions, we can categorically say that the CIA has deliberately attacked funerals. On one of those occasions, as many as 45 civilians may have died. More than 80 people died in total in that attack. As many as 45 of them may have been civilians. So a really shocking story about the kind of tactics that the CIA has been using out in Pakistan.
Well, in reference to that last one, I believe this is the one where you wrote in your article that they were trying to get Massoud, or one guy or another named Massoud, and that they didn't even get him anyway. They killed a bunch of civilians, as many as 45, you say. But then they only caught up with him a few weeks later, 6 weeks later.
That's right. The leader of the Pakistan Taliban back in 2009 was a notorious man by the name of Baitullah Massoud, and the CIA fired off a number of drone strikes in an attempt to kill him. As far as we understand, and we've got this from a number of sources, the CIA killed a middle-ranking Taliban commander in the hope that that would draw out Baitullah Massoud to his subsequent funeral. And it was that subsequent funeral, at which almost 5,000 people were reported at the time as having attended, that the CIA drones attacked. So this isn't an opportunistic attack. This was a deliberate, planned attack on a funeral at which a large number of civilians were present. Now, Baitullah Massoud wasn't killed in that attack, and nor were any senior Taliban commanders. As you say, Massoud was killed some weeks later in a separate drone strike. We do understand that about 80 people died in that attack. Some of them were militants, but as many as 45 of them were civilians. And I do think that's shocking. I think that is an extraordinary thing, and it gives us an understanding of the drone strikes that we haven't perhaps had until now, that this deliberate targeting of rescuers and of funeral goers. And I think this raises a whole host of legal questions about, you know, what is the legal status of such strikes? And there's some speculation today about whether these might constitute war crimes.
And now for something completely different.